one of the things that had struck me in the 8 years that I've been doing this job and watching the markets and talking to farmers and watching statistics from USDA is a feeling out there that when it's time to give the family farm over to the next generation, that might be a little bit more difficult than first thought a number of years ago. Also, I get from farmers who are in the 1,000 and less category sort of a feeling about, well, times are changing. And I can agree with that because in the 8 years that I've done this job, times have changed a lot in how you think about the marketplace in terms of the players, the international connectivity with the marketplace. This year is an ideal example with all the food shortage issues that we're seeing around the world, Pakistan, India, et cetera. And for the smaller operator, there's a sense when they talk to me is, how do I continue to be competitive in these changing, volatile times? And I'm talking about being competitive 4 years out, 6 years out, 8 years out, 10 years out, because that is my window for giving my farm to the next generation. And I want to be sure to be able to do that. And I'm not sure that I can do that. And I thought about that a lot, and I thought, well, what I could do is bring on to our panel some people who really deal with land issues and understand them inside out and have some perspective not only on the sale of land but have some great ideas for how to have producers and other folk, cash renters and the like, work with land ideas, because there's some great ideas out there, I think, that are not being used that might be used. And so what I asked these guys to do was to think outside the box. Pretend for a moment that you are one of these operators in the categories that you are now, of the group that's out here, and bring to the table ideas that will increase and sustain profitability, not by marketing of a crop, but other ideas. And that's what they're here to talk about. Murray Wise has a Bachelor's of Science degree in agriculture from Iowa State University. And, of course, if you've been around any length of time, you probably know about Murray because he's written a few books, including Investing in Farmland and Farmland Investment Strategy. He most recently formed Murray Wise Associates, and he is focusing on his reputation and his organization's reputation of selling land at auction and in private transactions. And so it is my pleasure to offer up the first of our several keynote addresses that we're going to be hearing today. Murray Wise, give him a hand, please.
First of all, thank you for the opportunity of being with you today. As most of you or some of you know, I was the founder and principal shareholder of Westchester Group that I sold on September 30th to the large pension mutual fund company out of New York, known as TIA Cref. In the next few moments together, we're going to talk about cash rents. We're going to talk about sort of the history of crop share rents. We're going to talk about the size of farming operations. We're going to talk briefly about world food. We're going to talk about vertical integration at the request of my good friend David. And we're going to talk about leases, three different unique, not necessarily recommending any of them, different ideas from a leasing point of view. One of them is called a participation lease. One of them is called an index lease. And one of them has become nicknamed the Illini lease. And let me tell you in advance, in my opinion, there is no perfect lease. In fact, I'm not even sure there's a desirable one. If you roll the clock back to 1976, when I entered this business, the crop share lease, without a doubt, was the most popular lease between landlord and operator. By 1982, when I moved to Champaign, let's look up these numbers recently, the crop share lease had declined to 50%, and 50% was cash rented. By 2007, this has changed again and changed dramatically, where in fact 77% of the leases in most of the Midwestern states today are in fact cash rent leases. A couple of statistics I ran across recently that I found of interesting, 2007 data. We all think of the large getting larger when in fact that's not totally the case. In 2007, USDA reports that the number of farmers reporting $500,000 of revenue or more had increased by 6,500 U.S. farmers. I don't think any of us would find that totally startling at all. The same token, the startling part to me was in that same time period, they reported those with gross revenue of less than $10,000 but claimed themselves as a farming operation actually had also increased by 2,200. So it looks to me like the large are getting larger, and in some cases the small, unfortunately, are getting smaller. If you look at my former company, Westchester, and look at the makeup of their farm operators, I think it's really, really interesting. And that more than 50% of the farm operators are, in fact, two generations. 11% of the people that they lease to are, in fact, three generations. Again, I think this is real indicative of where we've come from and where we're headed to. When I arrived in Champaign in 1982, if you farmed 1,000 acres, from my perspective, you were thought of as nothing less than gigantic. Those numbers changed, and by 1990, we knew a lot of people who were farming 3,000 acres or more, and today I'm here to tell you I don't even know what the definition of large is, given some of the farm operations that we see scattered throughout the Midwest today. World food is incredibly important. It was mentioned a number of times for the panels earlier this morning. Don't let that be swept under the carpet, because it's a driver for a lot of the unrest that we see throughout the world today. If you look at the caloric intake as measured by any food product of the Chinese people, it has absolutely skyrocketed in the last 10 years, and it will, in fact, in my eyes, continue to skyrocket. Dave asked me to touch on vertical integration and the threat of vertical integration. In other words, are the ADMs, the Cargills, the Smithfields, are they going to become major player in row crop agriculture? And I have a very definitive, maybe wrong, but a very definitive position on this, in that they, in my opinion, will never compete with the family farm operation. The family farm operation, particularly the multi-generational family farm operation out here today, is very, very efficient, in a lot of cases very, very profitable. Before we touch on three different unique off-the-wall leasing ideas I'm going to share with you, I want to tell you in advance I'm not recommending any of them, and as I've already stated, there probably is no perfect lease. I recently ran across what's called a participation lease. Personally, I'd never heard of it before. I ran across it not only here in the Midwest, but I ran across it on a North Carolina potato operation recently, where they were leasing with a similar set of circumstances. This particular lease, and again, these are these people's numbers, I'm not saying I'm recommending them, that the lease agreement called for total production costs of $450 per acre on corn. They take that $450, they add a rent amount, in this particular case, that happened to be $300 per acre, to take the lease to a total production and rent costs of $750, and the operator, if in fact their profits beyond that $750, which they're needless to say would be given today's commodity prices, the operator retained anywhere from 65% to 75% of that additional revenue, and the landlord was paid a bonus of anywhere between 25% to 35% of that additional revenue. The third lease I recently ran across is called an index lease, where in fact the landlord and operator agree that the upfront rent would be $350 per acre, and that the target yield on corn would be 200 bushels per acre, and the target price on corn would be $5 a bushel. Given those targets, I'm going to give you two different examples, but let's say that the farm yields 220 bushels. You take 220, divide it by 200, and you get an index amount of, or a multiplier of 1.1. Let's say the corn average is $6 a bushel. You take the $6, divide it by five, and you come up with an index or a multiplier amount of 1.2. So you take the 1.1, 1.2, multiply them together and multiply that new number times $350, which was the rent already prepaid, and there would be an additional about $112 per acre in additional cash rent owing. But let's take the worst, the downside, the same lease, and this lease called for both an up as well as a down. Again, let's say the farm only yielded 170 bushels per acre. You take 170, multiply it by 200, get an index multiplier of 0.85. Let's say the corn price averages $4.50 a bushel. You take 450, divide it by the $5 per bushel, the agreed upon price, you get a multiplier of 0.9. You take the 0.85, multiply it by 0.9, times the already paid $350 per acre. And that results in a set of circumstances where the operator would receive a credit of $82 per acre, not written as a check for that crop year, but as a discount on his next leasing year. Again, just some off-the-wall ideas that I've come across most recently. The most popular one is the one that's got nicknamed the Illini lease. It can have a base cash rent of anywhere from $250 to $350 per acre, or the typical rents that I've seen. You take the futures price in Chicago, and again, the leases I've seen, they selected four target dates for establishing price: January 15th, March 15th, June 15th, and October 15th. And let's say the average price was $6 per bushel in that period of time. This particular lease then called for $5 to be the base price of corn. So you take $600 or $6 a bushel, subtract $500 or $5 per bushel, and you end up with an additional 100 points. And all these leases that I've seen called for a payment of 50 cents per point. In other words, in this particular case, the landlord would receive an additional $50 in additional rent. Assuming that corn price averaged $4.90 a bushel, then there would be no additional bonus rent paid during that time period. One last quick example: if corn averaged $6.50 per bushel, you take $650, subtract $500, you get a multiplier of 150 times the 50 cents per point. The landlord would, in fact, receive an additional $75 per acre. Those are simply three somewhat off-the-wall examples that I've seen recently of unique leasing arrangements trying to enter into an equitable arrangement for both landlord and tenant. Keep in mind that I know most of you operators in the room won't like to hear this, but the landlord has reached a crossroad where he's more and more risk adverse. He just doesn't have a desire to maintain a high level of risk as he moves forward with his, leasing his farm operation. The last point I'd like to redundantly repeat: there is no perfect lease, in my opinion, or at least I've never seen one. The problem with most leases is they're usually wrong for the landlord and they're usually wrong for the operator at least some period of time throughout the lease. And this makes leasing very, very challenging, in my opinion. With that, I'll turn it back to Dave.
Thank you, Murray. Dennis Holt and Stephen Wright are with Farmers National Company. The home office is in Omaha. They didn't drive quite as far as that today. Stephen holds a bachelor's of science degree from Purdue University, and he currently serves at Farmers National as the area vice president with responsibility for overseeing company farm managers in Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. He's a member of the National American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. Dennis Holt holds a bachelor's of science degree in agricultural business, a minor in farm management from Iowa State University. He currently serves as an area vice president, and he is the managing broker for the state of Illinois for real estate activities, and he is an accredited farm manager. It's my pleasure to bring both of these gentlemen up to the podium. Please give them a round of applause.
Well, thank you, Dave. And again, between Steve, I am Dennis Hoyt, and we appreciate, this is our first opportunity to come to this Ag Day, and we really appreciate Dave involving us, and hopefully we can give you something that you can take home to think about. Again, as Dave set up, we were given the challenge to talk specifically about that smaller group of farmers that he took the poll of. How might you, I think he used the word, be competitive. You may also look at how you may survive in this environment that seems like it's constantly talking about growing, growing, growing. And so we're going to address that a little bit, and actually we're going to tag team this a little bit. I'm going to talk about a couple things, and then Steve's going to come up and address a couple of the factors that that we think are involved, and I'm going to come back and kind of wrap up and get a little bit of a summary. Well, you heard all morning about a market plan with all the grain, and the corn, and the soybeans. Of course, we think a critical part of that for all of you, regardless of the size, but maybe more critical to that group that we're supposed to address this morning, that smaller group, and that is that you need to have a much broader plan that's called your business plan. Some of you may be very familiar with that. You may already have it, but it really is critical from that small farmer that's either trying to compete or trying to survive to have a plan that's much more in depth than just his grain marketing plan. It's obvious that you need to have income goals. I don't know how many times this morning, if we counted the number of times that somebody used the word enough, what's enough corn price, what's enough bean price. Really, in your own operation, you don't know what enough is because it may be different to somebody else than you. The only way you're going to determine that is your business plan as you sit down and decide, am I going to stay the same, am I going to grow, or am I going to keep in this business? And how long you plan to do that? Are you 55 to 60 and you don't have anybody in your operation and you're going to look trying to wind this thing up before long? Or are you in that second, third-generation farm that Murray talked about is in many cases that you want this thing to happen a long time? That's going to have a big impact on that business plan and how you set and what may be enough that you need to look at. And, of course, critical, talked about this morning many times also, is a risk management plan. The extremes, of course, we're talking about grain prices this morning, but in all facets of your business, the extremes are higher than they ever have been. Volatility, the lows are lower, the highs are higher, and so the only way you can do that is find a way to manage that risk. And that will be different if you own all your land or if you rent a major portion of it. And it's also going to make a big difference for you and your individual plan. Do you have one landlord or do you have 10 landlords? If you have one landlord and that landlord decides to do something different with that farm, whether it's rent it to the guy that's farming 10,000 more acres than you are, or if they decide to sell the property, or if his owner objectives change and he decides to go from one type of lease to another one. You need to address the possibility of that happening in that business plan if you really contend to go in the future. And you may be aware of this, but across the Midwest, over 50% of the land is owned by somebody other than you that farm it. And actually, Illinois is the highest of the states in the corn-growing country, and Indiana isn't far behind, and that's between 60 and 70% of the land is owned by somebody that doesn't farm it. So for many of you, that might be your future or your demise. If you're that smaller operation and that's a big part of it, are you going to be able to keep that landlord happy? Are you going to be able to answer what he wants and provide him the return? And it may not always be because you can pay him the highest dollar. It may be for some other reason. So we're going to look this morning, and again, a lot of this stuff isn't rocket science. You've heard a lot of it before. We just want to kind of point it out that we've identified three factors that we're going to touch on this morning that might have to do with that. The first one is you got to find ways to be more efficient in your own operation. And you also need to find a way, how can you be potentially more appealing to that absentee landlord that's critical to your operation, especially if you have a small base. And then the third thing is how can you be open-minded and how can you be creative and maybe do something different than you've done in the past. So with that, I'm going to have Steve come up and talk a little bit about those first two, and then I'll wrap it up after that. Steve?
Thanks, Dennis. Thanks, Dave, for having us on here today. Tough position to be in, standing up here. The only thing that stands between 400 farmers that are hungry and the beef house rolls is this panel. So I'll try to go through as quick as I can. David asked me to talk about how the 600-acre to 1,000-acre farmer, what are some of the things they could do to compete with the larger farmer, and how do they survive in today and down the road. And talking about being more efficient, one of the concepts I want to talk about, there's a lot of ways to be more efficient, but I want to talk on one in particular, excuse me, for that size farmer, is if he could find the possibility or find the opportunity to partner with a neighbor, a neighbor of similar size and similar style. And when you talk about this similar style, it'd be very important. If you're the type of guy that dots every I and crosses every T, you probably wouldn't want to partner with the guy that goes out and has his cornrows crossed in the middle of the field, because you're probably not going to get along all that well. But if you're of similar styles, it's an opportunity. It's something to think about. The farmer that has between 600 and 1,000 acres probably sitting on $500,000 to $1 million worth of equipment. And if you're honest with yourself, that equipment could probably be run over two times or maybe even three times more acres than you do right now. And if you partnered with someone, that would give you an opportunity to truly amortize your cost per acre for equipment and probably free up some dollars for you to go out and buy specialty equipment, for instance, grain sprayers, grain carts, semis, things that could help you become more efficient on your farm. Being partner up and having going from 600 acres to maybe a couple thousand acres with a partnership, you become more appealing to a seed corn company. You know, they'd much rather deal with someone controlling 2,000 acres than they would someone with 600 acres, just simply because when they do land a sale, it's a lot larger sale. If you had that size of operation, perhaps you'd have a little more flexibility with fertilizer. Maybe you could buy it in bulk and own your own equipment to spread it. Same way with chemicals. Maybe you could purchase them wholesale and use your sprayer, amortize over several acres there to lower your costs for that. More appealing, you want to make yourself more appealing to the end user also. Having more acres at your disposal, probably the availability of specialty crops and contracts for specialty crops would increase. There's an end user in, or a producer, a farmer that I deal with on a regular basis who raises a specialty crop, and the end user finds him as a very appealing person to deal with and pays him a premium larger than most other people receive for that specialty crop because he's very flexible. If they need grain hauled in on a Sunday because their plant's going to shut down, he does it. He supplies them. He's the guy that brings that in. He brings value to that supplier. And having those extra acres, having those specialty crops, has truly offered him an opportunity to make more dollars per acre. Partnering with a neighbor, you might be an opportunity to reduce hired labor. You know, maybe right now you have some part-time labor or seasonal labor. And if two or three guys go together, maybe there's somebody to put a farmer in each one of the seats that need to be out there in the field those days. If you do go about this and you do decide to have a partner with a neighbor, one thing I would say would be an absolute must is get legal advice. Don't do this with a handshake. If you do it with a handshake with a neighbor, you're not going to be successful, because sometime down the road you're going to have a difference in opinion. Draw this up. Draw up an agreement and have someone look it over and give you legal advice of what you need to put into your agreement. Try to think of every scenario that would go into that agreement and have a way that you could amend it as you go down the road, because the agreement you put together today may fit perfectly, but 5 years from now very well may not. And then also have a termination terms in the agreement, because every partnership at some point in time is going to terminate, and that's just a given. that's going to happen. The other area I wanted to talk about, the second version of this, was making yourself more appealing to landowners. You know, how the 600 to 1,000 acre farmer, how does he make himself more appealing to landowners? And for the past 5 minutes, I've talked to you about how you ought to partner with your neighbor. And now I'm going to tell you how your neighbor is your competition. If he's not your partner, he is your competition. Every year I have, and I've been in farm management since 1987, so 24 or so years in this business. And every year I have young farmers come in, and sometimes a little older than young farmers come in, and say, how do I grow my business? I've been at 600 acres or 1,000 acres here, and I just can't seem to get any bigger. I don't know what I have to do. And I typically answer that question with a question, and with a series of questions. And the one I always start with, the farms that you farm right now, how have you made those farms better? What are you doing that's made those farms better than your neighbor would have done? Are you cleaning the fence rows? Have you gone out and cleaned up some fence rows? Have you cleaned the ditches up? If there's sucker trees growing out there, have you cut them off and put Toradon on the stumps and, you know, cleaned that up? Do you own a backhoe? I always tell young farmers, one of the most important pieces of equipment that you can own as a young farmer is a backhoe. You can go out here and do a lot of things on a farm, repair a lot of issues on a farm if you own a backhoe. And if you do, your neighbors notice it. The landowner next door notices it. If you clean up those farms, they notice it. Fix the tile holes on your farm. I mean, rather than hire somebody to come out there and do it, go out there and dig them up and get them fixed. Mow the roadsides. And when you do that, weed eat around the posts, the telephone poles and the corners. Take the time to do that. People notice that. Landowners notice it. Do you pick up the rocks? Now, some of these farms, you know, you probably never have any rocks on them, but occasionally there seem to be one show up here and then. So, you know, take the time to do that. Little things get noticed. Landowners recognize that if you take care of the small details, you're probably also going to take care of the large issues. Owners, the number one thing that owner wants to do on a farm, and we all know that, is make money. But they also want to be proud of their farm. And if you can help them be proud of that farm, be proud of that operation, you'll enhance their bottom line and you'll build a relationship. And building a relationship with an owner is extremely important. You know, what you don't want to do is, in a cash rent situation, send that owner 2 checks a year and think you've built a relationship. Yes, he's going to appreciate that money. He's going to appreciate those checks, really appreciate them if they come on time. But if you build a relationship with that individual, you're going to allow yourself a couple oops out there, that if you make a mistake, that he'll probably help you out and take a look at it and recognize it. But if all you're doing is sending him a check and that's all he knows about you, you've not built a relationship. Learn what those farmers' goals are. And if you know what your landowner's goals are, if you know what they are and help them achieve it, it would be deeply appreciated, and that all goes as part of building that relationship. What you're truly trying to do here is give that owner a reason to hire you. That, if you know, if all you're going to do is, if all you've ever done to that farm to make it better is keep the fertility the same or maybe improve the fertility, no one's ever noticed that but you. If you've gone out there and done the little things to make a difference, people notice it. The other thing is make the owner's farm, make it be important to you. Every owner wants their farmer to feel like that farm is very important to them. If it's just another, you know, farm in a large group that they have, Really doesn't make a difference in what their bottom line is at the end of the year. Most owners don't want to rent to that guy. They would much rather rent it to the guy that farm is important to his total portfolio, his total operation. It was mentioned earlier today, but I think it's worth repeating what Warren Buffett said on MSNBC last week, and that was he would rather own all the farmland in the United States than all the gold in the world. Now, that's a huge statement. We're all in a very good position here where we're at right now. We're in a strong industry, strong as it's ever been throughout my lifetime. And, you know, I hope you all are able to take advantage of this situation. Dennis?
Thanks, Steve. Well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up our portion. And again, initially I talked about three things that we were going to talk about. Steve talked about being more efficient and being more appealing. And the third one was to be open-minded or creative. And in some ways what this may mean is just you may have to do things differently than you've done in the past. And it could be different than your neighbor. You know, by nature, most of you in the room, and I would include myself in that, we're pretty independent people. Sometimes that may be an initial reason why you're farming. You didn't want to be somewhere with a boss telling you what to do, or you like being outside, you like the lifestyle. This business is certainly changing. There's no question about it. And if you're in that group that you're looking for survival, or how can I be competitive in this changing world, you may have to do things different. I heard a definition once of the word of insanity, and probably many of you have heard it too. And the insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. So you may need to look at what you're doing and be creative. One of those possibilities is you may have to consider, as long as it meets your business plan, and it goes back to why it's important to have a business plan, maybe accepting a smaller profit per acre than what you theoretically think in your mind that you ought to have. You know, I don't know how many times we deal with operators in a leasing situation, and they're just like, oh, there's no way that I would want to have those terms because I'm not going to make enough. Well, in some cases, he may not know what that word enough means, and it may just be philosophically he didn't think it's right for him not to make more money on a per acre basis than what maybe he did in the past. Well, there's somebody out there that is. It is willing to do that. Maybe it's because they're larger, because we all know it's simple economics, 101, profit is margin times volume. In some cases, you can't do anything about your volume. If you're in that situation, you've got to work on the margin. And if it meets your business plan, maybe it isn't what you think you ought to have, but maybe it ought to be considered. Maury mentioned that owners' objectives are changing. Again, Farmers National Company works with about 5,000 absentee landowners. We manage over 2 million acres, so we see a lot of landowners. And there's no question that they are changing. But in our shop, not every one of those landlords is only interested in the highest price for their land, for the highest return. The increase of landowners we deal with that are worried about that has increased over the years, but we still have another group of landowners that is a consideration, but it's not the absolute thing. So you need to think about the fact if you have landowners you're working with, their objectives may be changing. And as Steve said, if you aren't talking to them, if you aren't communicating with them, and if you don't know that, and they don't know that you care, they might make a decision and tell you after the fact, like I've rented the farm to somebody else, or we're going to sell the farm, or we're going to do something different. So you got to know your break even, you got to do that business plan, and be creative. In our shop, a little different than what Maury was talking about, we still do have a lot of landowners that share crop their farms. Again, on that 2 million acres, we have about 40% of our landlords still crop share their farms. Again, we're talking over a broader area. Some parts of the country are more share-type crops than other parts of the country, but we have about 40% in crop share, 40% in cash rent, the other 20% are something else. And we generally have about 6 or 7 lease types that we deal with. And so part of that being open-minded may need that you need to consider proactively of discussing and looking at some other alternatives, a way that you may want to be able to be willing to operate that leased land if it fits your business plan, if that's what it might take to keep those landlords. Of course, the cash rent and both fixed and variable, you know, Maury talked about 3 different variable types, and there's all kinds of different other types that, you know, we're working with, and some of those too. Those are certainly 2 of the lease types. There's also the crop share. I will say that in our shop. The majority of what I would call a traditional 50-50 crop share lease isn't that traditional anymore. There's some tweaking to that. It's going to be some type of vacation in addition to sharing 50%. It may be in some parts of the country it's more applicable. Maybe the operator is going to pay 100% of seed instead of 50-50. So you can go down through there and menu pick that. And the majority of the time, you know, we get the question, why is that? Why would you take this crop share lease and do something to it? Well, the main reason is because many cases you have a landlord who's still willing to share in price and production risk. But at the same time, they want to find a way to make sure and be somewhere in the upper portion of the opportunity they might have to get a return to their property. It's not that they're always willing to not share in price price risk and production risk, but if that's solely what they do, there's many situations is that puts them at the bottom of all the options they have. And so that's why they're looking at something different. And the other thing is, may need to consider going in and talking to other resources who you think might have contacts that could rent properties to you if you're looking to add land. And, of course, one of those would be a professional farm manager that may be in your area. I have some operators who will come in and provide resumes of them, basically portions of their business plan. Well, that's pretty impressive if I'm looking for an operator and I happen to have an owner who doesn't say, go out and get me the absolute top dollar you can get. So you need to be proactive. If this is a business, you got to operate it like a business. And then maybe something you need to do is to go out and network, be with the people, give them the information, and do the things that Steve's talking about is what I'm going to do for your farm if you rent it to me. And you may need to consider doing that with your existing landlords so they know what you do. Because you may be doing all that stuff, but if they live in California and they don't ever come back to farm, they might know that you took the time to weed eat around that sun. So with that, we're going to wrap it up. And again, as you've heard all morning, what an exciting time to be in agriculture. There is no question volatility is more, but our opportunity for financial reward and for making our plan work has probably never been better. At the same time, the consequences of your decisions, right or wrong, probably never has much difference. And indecision is a decision. So whether that's indecision to sell a crop, whether it's indecision to try to do anything to grow my business, I just want it to stay that way, you're making that decision. Many of you got into and are staying in this business for the lifestyle, and it's a great thing. I farmed myself for 11 years, and it's a great place to raise kids and to be on the farm and have that, but that business has grown. It's more than just that. If you're going to continue to survive, you got to be more of a businessman, have a business plan, especially if you're in what we might call vulnerable slot, and that is on the lower end of that acreage. So with all that hubbub, all the worry about what's enough corn price, is $6 enough, make sure and step back. We try to tell our operators that, and we certainly tell our owners that. Step back, take a look at your situation, and realize this is a great time in American agriculture, and the fact that you're helping to feed the world is a great thing. So with that, I'll thank you for me and Steve.
Thank you very much. Todd Gleason is out there somewhere with a microphone, so get your questions ready. We have about 10 or 12 minutes to look at this a little bit more. A question that I have for Murray is essentially this. In the last 10 years, Murray, because we heard this morning that what the marketplace is telling us is that we need to find more arable land, or we need to do something with technology or something with seeds, because the world is telling us we need more food and the population is beginning to outgrow our food capacities. So over the last 10 years, Murray, in all the different kinds of farmland sales that you have made, how much of that have gone to third parties, speculators, investors, commercial land developers, eminent domain, city, creep, you name it, as opposed to going back to the producer?
Thank you, Dave. In our particular case, we've not been involved with much going to developers or cities or eminent domain, but we are heavily involved with the investor side, particularly historically involved with the pension as well as some large individual investors. And I would estimate that somewhere in the area of 70 to 80% of our land sales would fall into that category.
And the same question for Dennis.
Yes. Over the entire company that we work with, the majority of the land is still being bought by farm operators. I think 80 to 90% of the overall land sales. Now, we're certainly in a time period where many of those land sales are affected and influenced the final price on the investor market. Except for the time when 1031 money was really hot and heavy, and we all remember that. It hadn't been that many years ago. There were a lot of non-ag people out here looking for land and pushing that value up. Of course, that is almost totally non-existent right now. We probably see more other types of investors, as Murray talked about, that are in the market that at any point in time ever. They are looking for land. However, when it comes down to the final drop of the gavel, if it's on an auction or whatever else, that the farmers, the people that need that asset for a portion of their business, still are buying the highest percentage of the land.
I saw this in Iowa, and I've been telling you, I've been doing this for 8 years now, and I don't believe I until just recently saw a five-figure sale for Iowa farmland, over $10,000 an acre. What, Murray, is the market trying to tell us?
Well, first and foremost, Dave, the market's trying to tell us that it's extremely strong, but you're right that it's only 60, 90 days ago that five-figure sale occurred in the state of Iowa, but since that time, there's been at least 10 sales at that level. So it's become a much more common number than we might give it credit to. But again, throughout the whole Corn Belt, we're just experiencing an incredible level of demand driven by many of the factors that were discussed here this morning. Obviously, commodity prices being the number one, but we're in a very strong marketplace, Dave.
What's the market trying to tell us?
Well, I would say that there'd probably be a lot of people in this room that would say that that situation had two neighbors with too much money in their pocket that day that showed up at the auction. But I think that is a situation that we see when we see a high number come in. It's typically it's a couple farm neighbors that are, or two or three of them that are bidding on a farm. And we talked about the large investors coming in, both domestic and foreign, and I've also had them. But when we get to the high numbers, they just don't want to be a part of it. They want to be in agriculture. They want the opportunity, but they've just not been willing to jump into this upside market.
Are there questions? You have a question, raise your hand. Everybody wants that beef house lunch. I heard Murray talk about that the landowner really wants to avoid risk, and I'm hearing more and more about the potential of cash rents well in excess of $300, and I've even heard of a few people mumble the word $400, and so I'm beginning to wonder, Murray, if the 1,000-acre guy who has quite a bit of his land cash rent is going to survive, is he going to have to offer new strategies that he and his cash rent landowner are comfortable with moving forward, or does he risk losing it to bigger farms?
I think the bottom line, Dave, is he'll either figure out how to adapt and work within the parameters of his various landlords, or he'll probably go by the wayside and lose the land to a competing farmer on down the road.
I hear about big corporations that are going to be controlling an awful lot of land. I don't know what a big corporation is. Is that like a Cargill or a Bunge or an ADM, or is that just a family farm that's got everybody involved in the farming operation? I don't know what the media calls a big corporation farm.
If I could take that one, that's a great question. I think it's both, quite frankly, and that the really big farming operations that I see today are basically family farming operations. You're not going to get a General Motors or a, whoever coming in, and I don't even think you'll get a Cargill or a Bunge coming in and buying any sizable quantity of American farmland. Now, the exception to that is the pension industry, and the pension industry has made a major play and will continue to make a major play in owning some U.S. Farmland, but they'll be leasing it back to an operating farmer. There's no circumstance where they'll be farming it themselves.
Can I follow up with that? You caveated that by American farmland. What about around the rest of the planet? Yeah.
Very, very difficult, different set of circumstances, Todd, and also a great question. Yes, your Bunges and others have made major plays in South America, primarily Brazil. I also think it's interesting to look at the country of Australia. For some unknown reason, Australia has never got divided up like America got divided up, and there's many farming operations in Australia that are 50 to 250,000 acres, and many of those are owned by, I would say the number one category would be wealthy British families, and a lot of those have come to the marketplace and changed hands in the last few years. But, Todd, your point is a great one. Outside the United States is a very different story than in the United States. Yes, Paul?
Where would be, in your opinion, and I want everybody on the panel to answer this one, if you had your choice of an investment tomorrow and you had to get in your car, where would you go and buy it, and what do you think you'd have to pay in that geographic area to get the best bargain for the buck?
Well, from my perspective, right here in the Midwest, and I know it sounds incredibly high priced when you talk about 7 to 9, Dave mentioned $10,000 an acre, but I still think in some of the high-quality regions of north central Iowa, as an example, there's opportunities in that $7,000 to $9,000 category of buying some very, very high-quality land. Even here in Illinois and Indiana and Ohio, there's still some opportunities if you're able to sort them out.
I would say the same. I would echo right here in the Midwest. A few years ago, I went to South America and Argentina, looking with an investor to follow that market down there, and we kind of come to the conclusion that we could get about a 1 or 1.5% better return in South America, but the political risk just didn't offset the value. So I'd say right here where you've got in the Midwest, where you've got a secure basis.
Well, as you all know, the investing in farmland has two different types of returns. It has your cash return and it has your future for the equity increase in that value. That changes based on your location. We can find some properties in Missouri, as an example. I don't think there may be a lot of people here from Missouri, but I work and manage in Missouri. So we can find some properties there that the cash return will be much higher than it could be on your $9,000 to $10,000 acre land here in Illinois and western Indiana. But the long-term prospects for equity increase in that does not add up when you add those two together than they would somewhere else. So certainly, as if you were looking at it from an investor standpoint, it would determine on your definition of how long do I want to hold it and what do I want. Do I need a cash return or do I want a combination of both, looking at sometime down the line? Also, the fact that you're going to buy that, how you're going to buy it as an individual or if you're going to buy it within an entity. As earlier talked about the land values in Iowa. Of course, one of the big things that affects Iowa is they do not allow any outside corporations to own farmland. It has a huge impact on their value of their land, versus Illinois has the most open land ownership, at least in the Midwest. And so that, again, allows a lot more of those investors and some other types of ownerships to come in and bid on properties. On the downside, that affected Iowa. On the positive side was the ethanol. Huge impact. How that industry is going will have a big impact in that north-central portion of Iowa. If you're looking at long-term investment, might choose, again, to be back here. And really, and we just don't see much better than Illinois and Indiana.
We have time for two or three more questions. Back there, sir.
This question is for Murray Wise. Murray and Westchester have been known for being able to look into the future and be fairly successful at it. Mm-hmm. And I'd like for Murray to compare and contrast and kind of expand on the concept that The Chinese are eating much better. The middle class is growing rather substantially. The standard of living is increasing, which means the cost of production for their goods is going to increase. I'd like to ask Murray, 5 years from now, who's going to stock Walmart?
Good question. First of all, I'm afraid that to the greatest extent it'll still be the Chinese. The only thing is, as consumers, we as Americans will be paying more for what we buy at Walmart and the other similar retailers, if you will. Through my previous business life, I had an opportunity to go to China once a year regarding our almond production in California, where we sent almonds to China for further processing. From 2006 to 2009, those wage rates doubled in that processing plant. Now, you know, they're not West Central Indiana or East Central or Illinois wage rates, but they went from $70 a month plus room and board to $140 a month. Again, they seem extremely low by American standards. By the same token, that gave those people some money in their pocket to buy American and other agricultural products to feed their family better, and that, to me, appeared to be their number one goal or objective. The other thing that will impact what we pay at Walmart, in my opinion, is the current oil price. If we stay at 105, and I heard numbers this morning that some people think that might be a conservative number on a go-forward basis, that not only will impact agriculture, but it will impact those products that we're importing to stores like Walmart and Kmart and Sears and others from Asia and other countries.
Over here, yes, sir.
Hi, Brian Stark with the Andersons. I'm just curious on you guys' opinion. As land prices escalate, is there any concern in the future we enter the risk of a bubble like we saw in the housing market, something similar to the 80s?
Go ahead, Steve. I think we probably have less risk today. That being affected with the bubble, it may correct some. I think we're in a different position than we were in the 80s. I don't think there's as many people leveraged as hard in this market as they were in the 80s. So I think we're in a lot better position there. I think if land prices do start to decline, I think that's when you're going to see the large investors jump in. Like Dennis said earlier, 80-90% of our farms right now are being bought by farmers. If that starts to back off just a little bit, I think you're going to see these larger investors jump in, because there's a lot of them that want to own a part of agriculture right now, because they think feeding the world is going to be a big issue for a long, long time, and it is. The whole world population is growing, and I'm not sure we're going to come up with more acres to offset that as quick, or the industry is going to increase the bushel yields as quick as we have to.
If I could also add to that, Brian, a good question, and the thing I think we heard from all the commodity panels this morning was that $7 and $8 corn isn't here forever. You know, we will have volatility, as all of your panels appropriately pointed out to us, and that's going to result in some softening land prices at some crossroad and probably some strength in land values at some crossroad. But if I could just add for 1 second, it's my understanding there's a sale in Western Illinois now at well over $9,000 an acre to an 87-year-old retired farmer. And when he was asked why he bought that farm, he said, well, I'm tired of the 0.6% return I'm getting on my money market account at the local bank. I can buy this farm, I can lease it to a kid I know just down the road, a young man who's farming, and I can get a much higher return than 0.6%. So there's a lot of drivers, a lot of forces, but I do agree with the comment here that this is very, very different than what we experienced in the 80s.
Let's give these gentlemen a round of applause, please.